You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Thursday the 9th of February 2023, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at radioalbion.com. As it's Thursday, that means we will be discussing geopolitical subjects today, and who better to do that with than geopolitical analyst Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson from rossjournal.org. Matt, good day, sir. How are you doing?
Yeah, who better? I don't know. I haven't come across anyone yet. But if I do, I will let you and the listeners know right away.
Oh, who better to discuss Platonism and myths and archetypes and the Russian Orthodox Church as well? I mean, you're a man of many talents, Matt, and I do have to say to listeners, do check out the Orthodox Nationalist from yesterday if you are interested in archetypes and myths. It is an excellent episode. But as we said, we're going to be talking about geopolitics today and mainly about Saudi Arabia and Syria. And we have an article by Stephen Sakhuni from Middle East Discourse that we are going to be using for our notes. And he says, in November 2022, Saudi Arabia formally changed its stance on Syria. Saudi Arabia is the political powerhouse of the Middle East and often shares positions on foreign policy and international issues with the United Arab Emirates, which has previously reopened their embassy in Damascus. The kingdom is keen to maintain Syria's security and stability and supports all efforts aimed at finding a political solution to the Syrian crisis, Saudi Foreign Minister Prince Faisal bin Farhan told the November Arab League summit in Algeria. And Syria was suspended from the Arab League in 2011 following the outbreak of conflict instigated by the United States and portrayed in the Western media as a popular uprising of pro-democracy protesters. Arab League Secretary General Ahmed Abul Gait said, "The developments in Syria still require a pioneering Arab effort. It is necessary to show flexibility from all parties so that the economic collapse and political blockage can be dispelled. Syria must engage in its natural Arab environment." The next Arab League summit will be held in Saudi Arabia, and there is a possibility of Syria once again taking its seat at the round table. On January 16th, the Syrian Foreign Ministry agreed to resume imports from Saudi Arabia after over a decade of strained relations, and Syria planned to import 10,000 tons of white sugar. This development signals a new beginning between the two countries. The Arab tribes in the northeast of Syria have traditionally had strong ties with Saudi Arabia and have received support from the kingdom. The tribes have opposed the ethnic cleansing and forced displacement of Arab villages, which the US-led YPG militia has conducted for years. Even though Saudi Arabia has been viewed as a US ally in the past, this has changed since the US military has supported the Marxist YPG, who have oppressed Syrians who are not Kurdish. The US-occupied oil wells in northeast Syria may come under attack by Arab tribes who are demanding their homes, farms, and businesses back from the US-supported YPG. And some analysts foresee the US troops pulling out of Syria after the Kurds find a political solution with Damascus. So all sorts going on here. It's very good news if Syria and Saudi Arabia get back together again. And it's something that I think might be even more on the cards after this terrible earthquake that has happened over there. Matt, what are your thoughts on Saudi Arabia and Syria?
Yeah, there's a lot happening here. We've spoken about Turkey's shift from the U.S. Now we're talking about Saudi Arabia's shift from the U.S. This is an absolute nightmare for the neocons. The Middle East is being – this whole constellation of powers, balance of powers being completely rewritten. One of the reasons, of course, is that Bashar al-Assad won the war, that the U.S. policy in Syria, even more than normal, is indefensible, supporting the communist Kurds who have been ethnically cleansing Arabs from this, the, you know, that part of Syria and northern Iraq where they are. They are a violent organization. I'm generally pro-Turkish in that sense. Turkey leaning towards Russia and China, and then of course the Crown Prince meeting with Russia and working on de-dollarization. This is, you know, this is absolutely enormous. But Bashar al-Assad being backed by Russia and Iran, he's not going anywhere. There's no point in, just because the U.S. wants them to cut Syria out entirely. So this is saying to the U.S., get out of there. You have no right to be there. The Russians do. You're only there for a handful of oil wells. The Kurds are really not your friend. They're no one's friend. They're a friend of whoever gives them weaponry. They're very deep into the drug trade as well. This is why wherever Kurds go, no one likes them. They're like the Albanians of the Middle East. They just seem to have that bent towards criminality and violence. And that's the only real support the Kurds have, at least for the most part, is the U.S. But the Kurds are also at war with the Arabs, which offends Saudi Arabia. So there's a million things going on here and a million reasons why Saudi Arabia is pulling away from the U.S. So you have in the Middle East, not including Iran, you have Turkey and Saudi Arabia, these two powerhouses, these two very influential states now moving towards Russia. You know, they don't have I'm predicting a color revolution. Now, I don't know, this is going to be delayed because of the earthquake, which is, you know, fortuitous as far as Turkey goes, only in the sense that they're going to postpone the election or what they're going to do. But the U.S. wants Erdogan out, as we well know, and this distance from the U.S. and move, not just distance from the U.S., but moving towards Russia and the entire, you know, this is frightening Washington. You're going to start seeing color revolutions. You're going to start seeing another wave of these. How they react probably is, given their support for Syria now, or, you know, slow but sure support, also leading towards Iran, which for Saudi Arabia you would think was unthinkable. But that's not the case anymore. Through the UAE, they're opening up limited diplomatic channels, and it's slow, but it's moving forward. A massive Israeli invasion, the resuscitation of the Western financed so-called ISIS movement. These are options that the West has. But all that's going to do, it's a temporary phenomenon that's going to completely alienate what little support they have. So this is, as far as American foreign policy and liberalism and the Great Reset and everything, this is an absolute nightmare for these people.
That's also the shared heritage, isn't there, between the Syrian Arabs and Saudi Arabian Arabs? So you've got a shared ethnicity there. I mean, it's just quite obvious that they should all be working together as part of the Arab League. Well, let's have a look at Turkey and Syria's relationship here now. Turkey and Syria have begun steps to repair their relationship, which ended after Turkey supported the US-NATO attack on Syria for regime change and hosted the CIA operations room funneling weapons and terrorists into Syria under the Obama administration. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad demanded recently the withdrawal of Turkish troops from Syria in order to begin to repair that relationship. Russia is brokering the reconciliation between Erdogan and Assad, which began with the Moscow-hosted meeting of the three defense ministers, and a meeting between the three foreign ministers is upcoming. The developments between Turkey and Syria are being watched by Iran. Foreign Minister Hossein Amirabdullahian said his country was happy with the dialogue taking place between Syria and Turkey. Amirabdullahian will travel to Damascus on Saturday for talks with Syrian Foreign Minister Mekdad. Iran is looking to establish a new role in the recovery process in Syria. President Ibrahim Raisi will visit both Turkey and Syria soon, his first visit to Turkey since taking office 2 years ago. While analysts see Saudi Arabia and Iran as antagonists, some feel the kingdom will ultimately realise they have to work with Iran in Syria and Lebanon Iran is part of the region and cannot be excluded from the geopolitical sphere. Well, Syria is going to need rebuilding, and it's not America that's going to do that. America is not even sending any aid for the earthquake. And I did see Bashar al-Assad pointing that out earlier, and he was saying that America is saying, well, Syria hasn't actually asked for any aid. Well, and Assad is saying, well, is not the pictures of all the damage that's been done, is that not enough? He actually sends out some really interesting tweets, Bashar al-Assad does. But obviously, Iran are going to want to go in there and help them. And Syria is going to get more help from Iran. And they'll probably need help from Saudi Arabia as well. I should imagine that there is room there for them to make money, both Iran and Saudi Arabia out of this, and also with investments. What do you make of what's being said here about Turkey, Syria and Iran, Matt?
Well, we talked about Turkey relative to Syria in the past. I'm hoping that the earthquake will give the U.S. reason to pull its troops out. There's not a whole lot there. They're really there to start a war, hoping that someone will blow them up. There's not enough to do anything else. They're there to guard oil fields and possibly the drug trade, hence their connection possibly with the Kurds, which has been going back since at least the early 90s. No one ever heard of a Kurd before. In the U.S. or Britain until Saddam Hussein and the invasion of Kuwait. But given this earthquake, this is going to change things in that now Syria and Turkey are going to have to cooperate. Syria's rebuilding is clearly being done by joint effort, really the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, Russia and China, and Iran is a observer member. But these are the three powers that are going to be rebuilding in this area, and the refusal of aid. Well, the U.S. has done more than this earthquake to destroy Syria. In the past, the earthquake in Armenia, there were concerts and there were TV ads and there were telephones and every celebrity was talking about it at the time. Now, of course, nothing, because they're not going to be involved in rebuilding anything unless. It's going to be done under direct American auspices, but not a whole lot of people really want to invest over there. Not until there's at least some level of stability. Russia and Iran have a clear interest in it, and it was a thriving economy prior to the 2011 American-inspired violence. So the lack of aid is telling, but not exceptionally surprising. Turkey and Iran do share a short border, and their overland trade is substantial. They are both very connected with one another, and it's not like the Turks can just back out. Any kind of work together in Syria is going to require some kind of repairing of relations. Saudi Arabia, as you already mentioned, also has an interest in rebuilding parts of Syria for a whole bunch of reasons. And this all kind of makes sense. You have the collapse of the dollar, the humiliation of the U.S. in places like Afghanistan, the clear defeat in whether it be Ukraine or Syria, two substantial defeats for the liberal forces. They don't trust U.S. policymakers. They don't trust the foreign policy establishment. And we'll talk here in a minute of the reform of Saudi Arabia itself, which is built towards, among other things, moving away from dependency on oil and hence the U.S. I said it before, but if you look at the board members of Aramco, every single guy, they're mostly princes of one kind or another, every single man on that board has been educated in the United States. I've said that every color revolution leadership has had its key members educated in the U.S., especially in the Ivy Leagues. We've talked about that before, too, which are hotbeds for CIA, among others. So I wouldn't be shocked if there's going to be a color revolution. There was definitely going to be one for the Turkish election in May. I don't know how this is going to impact that. And possibly in Saudi Arabia and maybe even the UAE as they start building their own home countries rather than attaching themselves to Western Europe or the U.S. But Turkey is all but gone. I don't know how NATO is going to survive a Turkish withdrawal, whether it be de facto or de jure. But to lose Saudi Arabia on top of that, I mean, that's going too far right now. But the wheels are set in motion. that would completely rewrite the politics of the Middle East, and American foreign policy is going to have to change radically as a result. So, but Iran, Turkey, Syria, this triangle, building relations that have been terrible in the past is probably one of the ultimate nightmares. And of course, benefits Russia too. One of the ultimate nightmares of Washington, D.C. How Washington, D.C. reacts, that's going to be – we have some indication of what's happening now, but this hasn't fully developed yet. And as this develops, we'll be talking about it.
Well, you mentioned there that there have been these reforms happening in Saudi Arabia. And it's interesting, as Saudi Arabia is pulling away from America, it's actually putting in more reforms in place, which are sort of making it more like a Western democracy than anything else. Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, MBS, said on April 27, 2021, that the country was undergoing a sweeping reform which would restructure the role of religion in Saudi politics and society. The process began a few years before he became Crown Prince, but under his leadership it has accelerated. Islamic institutions in the kingdom have seen changes in procedure, personnel, and jurisdiction. All of these reforms are in line with the future vision of the country. Some analysts feel the rise of the Muslim Brotherhood in the 1960s eventually gave rise to support for domestic religious institutions and eventually led to the funding of religious activities abroad while religious leaders at home wielded power over public policy. And now you get this change in vision. Saudi King Salman, custodian of the two holy mosques, and his son, MBS, have a plan for the country which is known as Vision 2030. MBS is also Prime Minister and Chairman of the Council of Economic and Development Affairs. The days of unlimited oil and markets are in the decline. Education, training, and employment opportunities are the stepping stones to building a thriving country, and MBS is determined to plan for a long future of growth and innovation. The Crown Prince is young and has new ideas. He is instituting sweeping reforms to the society, which have included more rights and freedoms for women. He has championed projects to place Saudi Arabia as a tourist destination, year-round golf and soccer venue, and encouraged cultural arts such as musical productions. MBS is breaking the mold. No longer will Saudi Arabia be a breeding ground for radical Islam. And I would look at that and I would say, yes, but aren't they still funding it in countries? Are they not still funding all the Islam in Europe? I mean, they might be changing things slightly in Saudi Arabia, but they do seem to still be funding it elsewhere around the world. What do you make of what's being said here, Matt, in this Vision 2030?
Yeah, the author, you know, we'll talk about a couple of other errors that he makes. He's simply going too far. I've been over both official and a lot of the non-official sources as to what this Vision 2030 is. It's not a secularization. I think the only real issue about women are some liberalization on driving. These are mostly procedural. You got to remember, there's the dual power in Saudi Arabia is the monarchy on the one hand, but also the Council of Religious Scholars on the other hand. And so there's this battle between the two. And no, it's not going to be secularization. That's simply not true. The Saudi form of the Salafism is very much into proselytization and in conversion. But the whole point of pulling away from the U.S. is going to require the centralization of political authority in the royal family. And then by extension, that has to come at the expense of something. It's going to come at the expense of some of these religious institutions. No doctrine is being changed, just who implements them and who's involved in on formulating them in terms of public policy. That's what's changing. So, you know, usually when stuff like this happens, there's all of these wild, exaggerated responses, like people saying that Saudi Arabia is going to be secular now. That's nonsensical. But it's just that the Crown Prince and the King, of course, who's very, very old, they're just not going to be going to this council anymore. They're not going to be going to some of the religious scholarship institutions anymore. And but Vision 2030 has nothing really to do with religion, except to strengthen Islamic identity. But there is a section there in the official reports about increasing the patriotism and nationalism of Saudi citizens. In other words, that has to be that has to exist if the royal family is going to centralize power and have more of a modern style state and bureaucracy rather than, you know, the old style family connection. And that's extremely important. And, you know, altering the nature of the bureaucracy, making it more modern in the sense of the modern European state. This really isn't about policy so much, except that the identical religious policy is going to be promoted from the royal family rather than from the Council of Scholars. I should note that there's been a huge pullout. You know, BlackRock pulled out of this vision 2030. You know, the media has, CNN has. They were involved in heavily in investment, BlackRock especially. But once after the Khashoggi killing in Istanbul, people were blaming, Turkey or Saudi Arabia for that, and that's the official cause of BlackRock pulling out. But that can't be a cause for a lack of investment. The cause for them pulling out is their withdrawal from the American orbit. Now this is happening slowly, but it's unmistakable, and we'll get more detail here in a little bit. The crown prince is the king's son, and these reforms really don't alter the social situation, but more of the economic situation, where they want to start investing in non-oil related things. I mean, I think 75% oil dependency in Saudi Arabia, 75 to 80%. They want to halve that over the next few years, and to have a very complex sort of modern economy by 2030. And that's going to require, you know, changes in education, changes in the religious institutions, at least how they function, and a centralized state that can direct all of this. And the crown prince is really the de facto ruling power in Saudi Arabia, but he clearly has his father's support here. This isn't secularization, and their Islam is always going to be radical, but it's going to be state-centered rather than from the religious bureaucracy.
Well, it does seem as if they're toning down the extremist preachers, and Saudi Arabia has hosted quite a few of them. Some were featured on satellite TV channels located in Saudi Arabia, and others were local preachers, authors, or scholars. Some had travelled abroad, preaching in pulpits and exporting their hatred and sectarian bigotry. One of the most famous preachers was Muhammad al-Arifi, who has had an electronic surveillance device attached to him by Saudi intelligence agents after they seized all of his social media accounts. His last tweet is said to be on May 6th, 2019, when he had 20 million followers and 24 million likes on Facebook, which ranked him as 10th in the Arab world and in the Middle East. In 2014, Great Britain banned Arifi from entering the UK, following reports that he was involved in radicalising three young British citizens who went to Syria as terrorists. A YouTube video in 2013 showed Arifi preaching in Egypt and prophesying the coming of the Islamic State. Egyptian TV reported Arifi meeting with the former Muslim Brotherhood Prime Minister, Hisham Kwandil, in his office. Arifi is best remembered for his statement to the media on Al Jazeera, in which he called for jihad in Syria and supported al-Qaeda. Adnan al-Arur is another extremist preacher who had appeared regularly on two Saudi-owned Salafist satellite channels. Arur was originally from Syria before settling in Saudi Arabia, and in the early days of the Syrian conflict he would stand up on camera, shake his finger, and call for his followers to grind the flesh of an Islamic minority sect in Syria and feed it to the dogs. These extremist preachers made it clear that the battles being waged in Syria had nothing to do with freedom or democracy, which the Western media was pushing as the goal. The truth was, the conflict in Syria was a US-NATO attack for regime change, and it utilised terrorists following radical Islam, who fought a sectarian war with the goal of establishing an Islamic state in Syria. Now, I would have liked to have had some more information on this Muhammad al-Arifi, considering his last tweet was 2019. They claim he has this electronic surveillance device attached to him. Well, where is he then, if they know where he is? And surely, if that was just a device around his ankle, surely he could just take that device off. Or was this actually implanted within him? What are your thoughts on this, Matt?
Well, last I checked, he's still in prison. In fact, apparently under very harsh conditions. But both of these guys, I don't know what he's talking about with these preachers talking about battle in Syria. Both of them came to prominence because they supported the battle against Damascus. Now, of course, there's no love there for America, but they're willing to make temporary alliances. That minority sect, I assume he's talking about the Alawites, you know, the Assad family is a part of. They've never said a statement like this. It's a very oddly worded paragraph. They are central figures in financing and building, especially since Arura is from Syria, in building these Islamic armies against Damascus. They're no friends of Turkey, though. So they're being silenced for two reasons. Number one, they're violently anti-Shiite. And with any kind of motion towards UAE or Iran, plus the fact there's a minority Shiites in Saudi Arabia, that's going to have to stop. And secondly, because of their slight change of policy in Syria, the Islamic movement that these guys helped create and helped finance, is the Saudis are withdrawing from that and betting more on Assad rather than these groups, which are fairly small, are awfully behaved, many involved in drugs. You know, this is what happens. Syria largely won that war. They're being artificially propped up in a small part of the country, and that's it. These guys, that was their whole big issue, was overthrowing the secular pro-Iranian government in Damascus, and they hate Turkey as much as a lot of Arabs do. But if Saudi Arabia is going to repair all of these relationships, these two guys have to go. And they have to go because they're calling them security risks or whatever. They over the top rhetoric. They despise the U.S. and Israel, but have no problem with what's happening in Syria coming from those two forces. They claim that they were on an ISIS death list, which I highly doubt, since ISIS is really an American intelligence operation, a Mossad operation. So that's why these guys have to go. This is the extreme side of the religious bureaucracy that that the reformed Vision 2030 is trying to get rid of. And yeah, this over-the-top rhetoric doesn't help either. But whether it be Syria, Turkey, or I really just had three reasons, Syria, Turkey, or Iran, the Saudi position is pulling away from these guys. Yeah, they're very popular. They're populist. And there's probably good reason for that. So, but this is, again, the author is exaggerating here. They never said anything like this, nothing to do with freedom or democracy, because we all know that. It's not a quote, but that was their whole issue, was indirectly supporting the U.S. and building up these militias in Syria. So those three reasons, these guys have to go. It's not necessarily the religious element, but it's a political element that matters.
So it's the anti-Shiite extremism element that is being toned down. Well, let's have a look here at the previous Crown Prince. Mohammed bin Nayef Al Saud, MBN, served as the Crown Prince and first Deputy Prime Minister of Saudi Arabia from 2015 to 2017. On June 21st, 2017, King Salman appointed his own son, MBS, as Crown Prince, and he relieved MBN of all positions. MBN met with British Prime Minister David Cameron in January 2013, and he then met with President Obama in Washington on 14th of January 2013. The discussion focused on the US-NATO attack on Syria and its support from Saudi Arabia. In February 2014, MBN replaced Prince Bandar bin Sultan, the then intelligence chief of Saudi Arabia, and he was placed in charge of Saudi intelligence in Syria. Bandar had been in charge of supporting the US attack on Syria. Bandar had been trying to convince the US in 2012 that the Syrian government was using chemical weapons. However, research has shown that the terrorists used chemical weapons to push Obama into a military invasion based on his speech about the Red Line. In March 2016, MBN was awarded the Légion d'honneur by French President François Hollande, another partner in the US-NATO attack on Syria. On February 10th, 2017, the CIA granted its highest medal to MBN, and it was handed to him by CIA Director Mike Pompeo during a reception ceremony in Riyadh. MBN and Pompeo discussed Syria with Turkish officials and said Saudi Arabia's relationship with the US was historic and strategic. Just months later, in June, MBS would depose MBN and strip him of powers, in a move considered to be upending decades of royal custom and profoundly reordering the kingdom's inner power structure. US diplomats argued that MBN was the most pro-American minister in the Saudi cabinet. That is what brought MBN down. The days of blindly following the US directives are over in Saudi Arabia. MBS has refused to bow down to Biden when he demanded an increase in oil production. The Vision 2030 that MBS developed does not include financing failed wars in the Middle East for the benefit of the Oval Office. MBS has a strained relationship with Biden, and he wears it as a badge of honour. I mean, that was very embarrassing, wasn't it, for Biden when he went over there to get them to stop with the oil? And I seem to remember when Trump went over there, they had a special sword dance for him, and he did some billion-dollar deals. So it was really quite embarrassing for Biden to go over there and not come back with what he wanted. Matt, what do you make of this new crown prince that is running things?
Well, this is part of the entire shakeup that the Vision 2030 is all about. They're absolutely correct about MBN. He was an embarrassment because he was a propaganda tool for Iran and Saudi Arabia's enemies. You're just an appendage of the United States. Americans, or at least American-educated Arabs, run that country. But the guy's right. Those days are over. Very few people take Biden seriously as a man or as a leader. But it comes down to the U.S. overplaying its hand in Syria. You know, the U.S. has been involved in firebombing crops. I mean, clear acts of mafia-style terrorism. And, of course, as I mentioned, the total lack of trust in the American economy. So, yeah, Biden kind of waddles over there and his people try to get a deal with, you know, oil production, and that fails. And right around that time, of course, Putin comes in and starts the process of de-dollarization. Obviously, you know, Saudi Arabia and Russia have far more in common than Saudi Arabia and the United States. The American ruling class have condemned Saudi Arabia, even at their closest, for being too religious and you know, not allowing abortion and all that kind of thing. So and a huge part of the foreign policy, including the neocon establishment, has been low-key at war with the Saudis for those reasons. This is not changing in Saudi Arabia, and this is just now a symptom of that, where the whole Biden administration and the American refusal to pull out of Syria is now destroying relationships with even their closest ally. Saudi Arabia was closer to the U.S. than Israel ever was. So the Saudis never, you know, attacked American naval vessels. But they're largely going for a certain self-sufficiency. This dependence on the oil market is something that has to go as the oil slowly runs out. But once, you know, from 2008 to COVID, it was a realization that everything has to change here, including their foreign policy. But to have this guy, I mean, by the way, he wasn't just MBN wasn't just stripped of power. He was arrested. He was charged with treason. And I don't know his situation right at this second, but he had been in prison for a while. This wasn't just a power struggle. This was a matter of policy. He was arrested. He was thrown in prison. But this means, so long as, you know, MBS remains in power and his father remains alive, although I don't think those two things are necessarily connected, they're going to slowly build relationships with Iran, Turkey, and Syria. And indirectly, Russia and China, something that we've talked about here for a very long time, but losing both Turkey and Saudi Arabia, I don't know how the U.S. is going to be involved in policy at all. But as I said before, these Western companies like BlackRock and, you know, CNN pulled out of these deals of Vision 2030 precisely for this reason. They never really gave anything but a stupid official reason, but this is the real reason. And whether Israel is panicking or not is another matter. And I think at least with this new government, they are extremely upset by this development. And they're all against sanctions on Iran in these countries now. and it's changing radically. I don't know how the U.S. is going to be able to function in the Middle East, except just in Israel, and maybe a Gulf state or two. I don't even think that could happen without those two countries being on board, and they're not on board anymore.
Well, let's finish up with a recap of Saudi Arabia's role in the Syrian war. Saudi Arabia played a huge role in the large-scale supply of weapons and ammunition to various terrorist groups in Syria during the Syrian conflict. Weapons purchased in Croatia were funneled through Jordan to the border town of Deraa, the epicenter of the Syrian conflict. At the height of Saudi involvement in Syria, the kingdom had their own militia in Syria under the command of Zahran Alush. The Jaish al-Islam are remembered for parading women in cages through the Damascus countryside prior to massacring them. In summer 2017, US President Donald Trump shut down the CIA operation Timber Sycamore, which had been arming the terrorists fighting in Syria. At about the same time, Saudi Arabia cut off support to the Syrian opposition, which was the political arm of the terrorists. Richard Dearlove, former head of MI6, expressed his view at the time that Saudi Arabia is involved in the ISIS-led Sunni rebellion in Syria. Syria has been destroyed by the US and their allies, who supported the attack beginning in 2011. Now, Turkey and Saudi Arabia are looking to find a solution which will help the Syrian people to rebuild their lives. Both Turkey and Saudi Arabia have turned away from past policies which found them supporting the conflict in Syria at the behest of the US. There is a new Middle East emerging, which makes its own policies and is not subservient to US interests. Matt, what are your final thoughts on this today?
Well, there's a couple of errors here. Jaish al-Islam isn't just a spokesman or the official militia of Saudi Arabia over there. They're supported by a lot of different groups. They haven't been created directly by Saudi Arabia. Zahran Alush was killed in 2015. He doesn't seem to have gotten that memo. Now, as far as Dearlove's comment from MI6, I think he's aware that he's simply making it up. Trying to connect Saudi Arabia with ISIS, at least for propaganda purposes, is may be one of the ways the Western world reacts. Because the author says right here, Saudi Arabia cut off support to the Syrian opposition. So clearly, Jaish al-Islam isn't theirs, although they have joined other coalitions. Trying to use the ISIS boogeyman, which again is a Western creation, to humiliate the Saudis, that may be just one path that the establishment is going to take. Timber Sycamore, of course, was supporting and officially, I mean, openly supporting al-Qaeda, which of course makes a mockery of the 9/11 narrative. And since they're being used anything against Damascus and hence Russia. So there's a couple of errors here, but the conclusion is absolutely correct. Saudi Arabia has disengaged from Syria. They're in a series of negotiations with Turkey, and the U.S. is being left out in the cold.
Well, I'll just finish up by also pointing out, you know, understanding that the United States was using ISIS in Syria helps you to understand why Ukraine is full of neo-Nazis being used against Russia. Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Matt. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I will be back tomorrow with Grandpa Dan. God bless and hail victory.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.